From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's our weekly listener mail segment. We are so thankful that you and your fellow conspiracy realists write to us via email or tweet to us or find us on social media or, in many cases, give us a call. We want to share your stories with the world. So I believe today we've talked a little off air, and Matt, you found a voicemail that touches on something we have, oddly enough, never examined in almost a decade on the air.
It's very true, and it was brought to us by an anonymous person who listened to a recent episode and thought about his own experience. I'll let him tell you about it.
Hey, Matt, Ben, Noel. I apologize to the mysterious super producer, but I haven't quite remembered your name yet. I hope you're all doing all right during these really crazy times. I wanted to talk about how similarly relatable the Floridelis cult and how it sounds quite relatable to my experiences as a child and a teenager. Have you ever considered talking about the foster care system or even the harrowing things that happen to a lot of kids in the system? I can say I met a lot of monsters under human skin and was both birthed and adopted by some pretty horrendous sociopaths. Perhaps you could even discuss narcissistic personality disorder, a very specific kind of sociopathy. Anyways, love your show. Keep up the fantastic work.
Wow. Okay. Obviously, thank you for the kind words. Thank you for that. Thank you for listening and for sending us this idea of discussing the foster care system specifically within the United States, but I'm sure examining that system in any country, you would find some stuff that they don't want you to know. Mm-hmm. You mentioned specifically something called narcissistic personality disorder, which is something you can find in statistic manuals that are used by psychiatrists and psychologists across the globe. And I guess we can just start there, maybe. Like, what does that mean? This term that you mentioned, we have talked about psychopathy and sociopathy. We've talked about these things before on this show numerous times, but this one I don't think we've actually covered. So let's just go to the Mayo Clinic just to tell you what they say, at least. They describe it as one of several types of personality disorders. It's a mental condition in which people have an inflated sense of their own importance, a deep need for excessive attention and admiration, troubled relationships, and a lack of empathy for others. But behind this mask of extreme confidence lies a fragile self-esteem that's vulnerable to the slightest criticism.
And I would add a couple of things there. That's a great starting definition. I would add that for people with NPD, relationships are all transactional. So something, you don't really regard other people as a person. They don't have, like, they wouldn't have the right to exist as a person. You're the person in the world. And the idea that a friendship might exist is really defined by what they can do for that person, what transaction they can accomplish for that person with NPD, and also the idea of fragility of self-image ties into pretty often an overinflated sense of vengeance. Like, if you, even if a narcissist is dead in the wrong And you point out, if they feel like they lose face, as is sometimes said culturally, then there will be a lot of energy put toward somehow, quote unquote, punishing the person who had the audacity to be right or point out whatever terrible thing the MPD individual was having, was doing. There is one thing I want to point out here on MPD specifically. A lot of times there are children raised by parents with this condition who, you know, the strangest things seem normal, right? Even when you're an adult, the most beautiful and most terrible things become normalized so quickly. When you're a child, you often don't have the wherewithal to realize that the way you are being raised is maybe not a healthy way, right? It's maybe not a way that you yourself would want to raise a child. And, you know, it's only years later that people come to find as adults that what was happening to them was not right. And it was not good for you. So I'd like to recommend just at the top, a resource, a subreddit actually, where you can share your stories. It's called Raised by Narcissists. So go to reddit.com/r/raisedbynarcissists and you can find and share your stories. Now, please do not mistake that for medical advice. And please don't, you know, presume to give people medical advice if you're not a doctor. But I think when you can feel so alone in the world, and especially if you're living with a 24/7 MPD, then it can be helpful to know that you are indeed not alone in one sense or another.
Thank you for doing that, Ben, and for providing that. One of the most important parts of this is that each of us, no matter who you are, where you grew up, what those circumstances were unique to your experience, right? There is not a single other person that went through whatever it is that you went through, positive or negative, as a child. And now, whatever you're going through right now, nobody is exactly like you. But those commonalities that bring us together, I think, are sometimes the most important. Because like you said, if you can find a subreddit of people have been through something similar, and you can actually share with that. That is a great way to move forward if you're struggling with something. It's kind of weird, I guess, that we started talking about this disorder, because really what we're talking about is who within the U.S. and the foster care system is eligible to take in a child for the system to say, yes, you are, we trust you in some way or at some level to take care of a child. In all things, feeding, clothing, housing, you know, caring for a child's emotional needs, which is maybe something that I don't want to say it gets overlooked, because if you think about it this way, to have the number of children that enter the foster care system within the United States every year, there have to be an overwhelming number of good people who are trying to do good in what they are doing to take care of children. There just has to be. I'm saying that as an opinion, just because to have in 2007, 293,276 children entering the foster care system, and then having that number wavering between 290,000 to the lowest number was in 2012, when 251,352 children were entered into foster care within the United States. I mean, if you didn't have good people to a large extent taking care of these children, then I feel like we would see a very different general picture, maybe. And maybe I'm completely wrong, because I'm so far removed from it and I just don't know yet. We haven't delved into the statistics and enough personal experiences yet. But I would just say, to take on a child that is not yours, to raise that child and take care of them, is a massive undertaking. And I don't know. I want to give props to parents out, to foster parents out there who are doing good and know they're doing good.
Well, I can completely speak to that. My ex-wife's sister was a foster, and her husband were a foster family, and they adopted almost every single kid they took in as foster kids. So they now have this massive extended family, and they adopted three siblings who all, you know, were separated under the foster care system initially. And then she, you know, fostered them all together and then adopted them. So that's a success story, I would say. And there's obviously a big but here. That's why we're leading with this, right?
Well, I mean, there is a big but because, like our caller, there are so many reports of awful experiences within the system. And that doesn't mean, you know, an individual parent adopting or parents like that, like your example, Noel, adopting. Sometimes it's just part of the system where so many children get adopted under one roof, the way we saw with the Fleur de Lis cult and in other places, in other instances. There's all kinds of abuse that can occur, whether it is making use of the money that is afforded to a family when they foster a child, the breaks that you can get on your taxes and all these other things. There are ways to abuse the system. And as we've also seen throughout the history of this show, there's a cavalcade of ways to abuse a child with whom you are given guardianship.
True.
I don't even know what else to say. I haven't done enough looking into this. There's a Frontline piece from PBS looking at the child welfare system back in the 90s, and it was really focused on it, and it painted a pretty grim picture of what was going on.
The statistics are troubling, and even just the cursory statistics prove that there are serious systemic problems with the foster care system. I have a little bit of personal experience, but more secondhand. I knew a lot of foster kids growing up and in my times traveling around. So the thing is, we cannot speak to the foster system in other countries. We can speak a little bit in the U.S. because there's a lot of research that's been done. John Hopkins found that children in foster care are 4 times more likely to be abused sexually than a peer child in a non-foster care setting. Children in group homes are 28 times more likely to encounter abuse. We also know that researchers in New Jersey concluded no assurances can be given that any foster child in the state is safe. More than half of the trafficking victims that were children that were recovered through FBI raids in 2013 were from foster care or group homes. And there's an entire world. I mean, you can say this about so many things, but there's an entire world that most people will not know about here unless we have direct impact with it or unless we know someone somehow. And we have to be very careful, and I appreciate that you're doing this, Matt, not to paint with a broad brush. We're not talking about these families. We're talking about a system that needs to do its best for some of the most vulnerable parts of the U.S. population. I mean, think about short stays alone. Right? A short stay is where a child is removed from their home due to what authorities would consider a credible fear for their safety, but then returned within days. So think about that. If you're 5 years old, you think you've been kidnapped, right? No matter what those people say, you've been kidnapped and somehow returned. That's pretty traumatic for a kid to experience. And even when these agencies have their best intentions, right? They're not really kidnapping kids. They're trying to keep kids in a safe place, but the damage is done. And with foster care, I think it's the right thing to do for us to do an episode on this.
Absolutely. I'm going to consult with my wife, who is a school psychologist, who deals with children who often have emotional or behavioral issues prior to being placed into a foster care system, where they are then living in extremely close contact with numerous other children who also have emotional behavioral disorders. And when you create an ecosystem like that, a lot of times it's not even the foster parents or the people running whatever the foster home is that are doing the abusing, because it's so much of our behavior as humans is learned. And it's just, we're going to get into some serious, really seriously dark topics when we do this episode. And I hope you'll come with us. But also, you know, hopefully we can maintain at least that sense that there could be a positive way through.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I think what you're pointing to, Matt, is just the vulnerability of children in foster care. They're very vulnerable to things like trafficking, like human trafficking, because of their unstable upbringing, often that they can be easy prey. Not to say that the foster parents themselves are doing this at all. It just could be they run away, or they are putting themselves in risky situations, and maybe they're targeted in that way. But there's certainly other aspects to it as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many issues. I guess what I was just getting at, Noel, is just saying that someone entering, and it's so hard to generalize like this because every single person has had a different experience in the foster care system. It's just stories that I've heard come through that sometimes it is the kids themselves who, because of what they have experienced, reflect some of the emotional, mental, physical abuse on their surroundings, no matter what their surroundings are. And when their surroundings are other kids who are also vulnerable, it just becomes a really messed up cycle. I'm not going to cry talking about this, but it there are so many really heart-wrenching stories that have come out of the foster care system, specifically in Atlanta. My God.
Yeah. Children who have been brought up in abuse, such that physical violence is a primary means of communication, and then find themselves in a group home attempting to communicate. I believe that we as a species do not fully understand the long-lasting impacts that early childhood education can make. And one of the misconceptions about early childhood education is the idea that it starts at kindergarten in a school with a licensed professional. Early childhood education is everything that happens to a child in their early childhood. It is all an education. Children are very, very smart and absorb information. When we talk about education, I mean, look at the long-lasting, disturbing trends with a likelihood of dropping out of high school. You know what I mean? Again, it's not because these children are any different. They're certainly not any worse than any other kid out there. It's a matter of the opportunities given or withheld. And this is something that I hope, fellow listeners, I hope you understand that we take this very seriously because people's lives are on the line. And we have done in the past, we've done some work with activists who are looking at the juvenile criminal system, right? We've done some work about the assimilation attempts that countries like Australia, Canada, and the U.S. Instigated upon native populations. Again, you know, or at least I'm taking pains to say that the idea that you would rescue and adopt as your own child, a kid, right? Just a kid who needed help. That is a beautiful, noble, amazing thing. And it's something that I think is very human and to be commended. But the problems with this system often come about because of underfunding, because of a lack of oversight, and because in some cases, these caretakers have ulterior motives or they have bad motivations. And the system that is meant to monitor that is often woefully overcrowded, right? And underfunded. It always seems like the good guys are outnumbered, you know, to put it in very simplistic terms. But you're right. We absolutely should do an episode on that. And we want to hear your stories if you're comfortable sharing them.
Absolutely. Please. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. Our email is conspiracy@iheartradio.com. Please reach out. Okay. And with that, we're going to hear a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with another message from you.
And And we're back with more listener mail. This one comes from Jason, and he listened to our Bronze Age episode and had a little bit of interesting context to add. And this is what Jason says. Hey, guys, big fan of the show. You just wanted to point out a huge historical factor that you didn't cover in your Bronze Age episode, the biblical judge Joshua. He was the first Israelite to lead the charge of his people into the Promised Land and was given instruction to utterly destroy all the cities they came into contact with. Burning was commonplace, and they took over a vast majority of the territory within the span of Joshua's life. He goes on to reference the Sea Peoples, the famous Sea Peoples, also sound an awful lot like the Philistines, who happen to be one of Israel's longest standing and most pain in the side enemies. And guess what? The Philistines were huge purveyors of iron. They were feared for their penchant for slave trading, pillaging, and brutality. Whether or not y'all believe in the Bible, there are historical records in its pages that aptly describe a lot of mysteries. Thanks for doing the show. Really enjoy the work and due diligence you give to each episode.
Appreciate so, that, Jason.
Yeah, really, very much so.
Ben, can we point out that he signed that, Jason, you signed this Taters?
He did sign it Taters. You know, it was below the fold. I almost missed that entirely. That's great. So thanks, Taters, for that. And it's a good point. It's something that I know you came across in your research for this, Ben. And you pointed out a really great article from Newsweek that made a similar connection between the Philistines and the Sea Peoples.
Yeah, that's right. This is something, this is a little bit of a peek behind the curtain when we're working on our core episodes, especially very big topics like the Bronze Age collapse. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are things that we do such that we can provide, hopefully, an introduction to a concept with some dives in there, but more something that illuminates a path for your own research and your own, you know, we want you to find the papers for yourself as well. We want you to dig into the weird corners and get back to us. One thing I think we do mention there, which you picked up, Taters, is that I'm going to just keep calling Taters.
Oh, please do.
Is that there is a... there is a mystery still afoot in 2020 about the identity of these folks collectively known as the Sea Peoples. And this mystery is still being solved. Noel, we were talking off air a little bit about this concept that DNA research will perhaps help us figure out the ultimate identity of the Sea Peoples. But it goes to that bigger question, which I love that you brought here, Noel, and I love that you wrote about here, Jason, which is, to what degree are biblical events confirmed by the secular historical record? And that's a tricky thing. So I'm going to be honest, when we were working on our Bronze Age collapse research, we talked maybe a little bit about some of that, but it's almost its own episode, right? Like, was there a biblical flood? It's on that level, you know?
Mm-hmm. It is. And it's also a little, you know, not that we fear to step on toes too often if we're doing our due diligence, but you're right, Ben, to just have it as a footnote in this is almost doing it a disservice, because honestly, you're right. The idea of where do the historical records line up with the course of events depicted in the Bible, that in and of itself, big picture, is an episode, if not a series of episodes. But the Newsweek article points to the potential identity of these so-called Sea People, who were this group that was potentially responsible for this massive cultural shift in that part of the country. And they were, of course, you know, given their name, a seafaring folk. And they were, in fact, as is mentioned in the email, very active in conquering and pillaging and kind of sweeping through the land like a plague, attacking places like Canaan, the biblical land of Canaan, which is a real place, Syria, and Egypt as well. And when you're dealing exclusively with artifacts, it makes it a lot harder to really figure out who an entire race of people that maybe are no longer around were. It's difficult to do that kind of detective work using only digs and excavating, you know, certain artifacts. But now that we're able to essentially analyze ancient DNA, it becomes a little easier to sort of narrow down the possibilities, right?
Yeah, the technology has advanced quite a bit, although you do have to find a source of DNA to do any kind of, you know, full forensic looking or full forensics on that DNA, right? You can't just take bones that are fossilized or too old, but there are instances now where you can get a better sample of DNA from an older body, let's say. In the case that we're talking about specifically here, there were 10 individuals that were recovered near the port city of Ashkelon, which is a really interesting place, biblically speaking. It was a Philistine city, and they're really trying to understand these scientists, researchers who are taking a look at this, doing the digs there and looking at the bodies, the skeletal remains that are there. They're really trying to figure out the origins of these 10 individuals that were found, right? And this was from 2019. They've been publishing findings in Science Advances, and they're saying that the people that they found, these 10 individuals, date back probably 3,500 years ago. Really interesting stuff. And they appear to be very different from most of the individuals who lived there at the time. So that's why the researchers are thinking perhaps this was a migratory people or a specific, you know, group of people that migrated at some point to Ashkelon and to this area. Yeah, they're saying that it really does appear to fit with the estimated time of the Philistines' arrival to this area. At least, you know, again, when we're talking about the differing records that exist out there.
That's right. And this study came out of the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History and was headed up by Michael Feldman, who said, quote, some interpretations of ancient texts have suggested the Philistines were one of the groups that comprised the Sea Peoples. And that's the same thing that Jason mentioned in his email. He goes on to say, our genetic results could fit with this hypothesis since we detect a movement of people that crossed the Mediterranean and reached Ashkelon in the relevant time period around the 12th century BC. However, from the genetics, we cannot determine whether these ancestors of the Philistines that migrated to Ashkelon were indeed part of the Sea People or not. So it's, you know, it's vague. It points to this could fit, but the jury is somewhat still out. But I did see another article that similarly speaks to the idea of historical record agreeing with or disagreeing with events in the Bible. And this comes from a site called Haaretz. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that. It is an Israeli news site. And it's true. I mean, this does figure into that thing that we talked about at the top of this segment about how sometimes disputes between the historical record, you know, in terms of artifacts and DNA and things like that can conflict with the record that's in the Bible, and that can be very divisive. And we're not going to get into it today, but I do recommend checking out another article about archaeologists looking to find signs of Joshua's conquest, which is mentioned in our listener email as well, in the last unexplored biblical city, a city known as Tel Shimron. And you can check out that article that goes much more into Joshua's conquest and the kind of burning through enemy civilizations that was mentioned in the email. You can go find that yourself on the website haaretz.com, haaretz.com, and look for this article by Ariel David from 2018. And with that, I think we'll take a quick break and then come back at you with one more listener mail.
And we're back with one more piece of listener mail. Buffy has written to us, Buffy L. You said, I would love to hear your take on Lyme disease and if infected ticks truly could be created by our government at Plum Island, right by Lyme, Connecticut. Buffy, you added, I just read Bitten, So Crazy. Also watch Lyme Crime. The disease, diagnosis, treatment, everything involved is so incredibly controversial, Everybody's getting diagnosed, it seems, and no one knows what to believe. Thanks for your consideration. Buffy, thank you so much for writing to us. This is something that Doc and Matt and Noel and myself talked about a little bit off air, because you see, there is a font of conspiratorial belief here. The idea that Lyme disease was not something discovered in the wild or evolved in the wild, but instead something created and then either through design or by incompetence let out into the world at large. Guys, I had asked you both a little bit off air if you had known anyone with Lyme disease or if you had ever heard of the conspiratorial stuff. No cheating, Matt, because I know you heard this one years ago, right?
Well, yeah, we've had people writing to us about Lyme disease for a while. and we've mentioned Plum Island before, which I know is something that always crops up there, as it did in that message. It's weird because this is one of those topics that makes you wonder if you're going down a conspiracy rabbit hole and giving in to conspiracy thinking. Lyme disease, I would say, is one of these gateway topics that, you know, maybe someone encounters because someone has contracted Lyme disease. Isn't it an astounding number of Americans that contract Lyme disease every year?
Yeah.
In the hundreds of thousands?
Yeah, that's correct. I believe it's something like Lyme disease is the most common disease spread by any ticks in the Northern Hemisphere. It affects some 300,000 people in the U.S. alone. So not counting Canada, not counting Mexico, just the U.S.
A year?
Yeah. That's wow. An estimation. That
wow.
And we have to be careful with effects. But that's according to the New England Journal of Medicine from 2016.
Wow. Yeah. So I guess just what I'm saying is a lot of people become aware of Lyme disease, what it is, and then directly connected to it, I think, is the question of whether or not the U.S. government had anything to do with creating a biological weapon.
That's so weird, because, you know, I grew up in the outdoors a lot, and I always knew about ticks, and I knew a little bit about Lyme disease, but I had never heard that it was something manufactured. It was just for, you know, when you're a kid, one of the weirdest things about ticks is they love the warm, dark places of the body. So you have to watch out for, you know, your crotch and your armpits and the back of your knees. And I think I, like a lot of kids, was just rightly terrified of the idea of one day stripping down to your skivvies and seeing a tick attached to your unmentionables, you know?
You guys have had ticks before, right? Ever? Like a tick attached to you somewhere?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, sure. I've had my fair share of attachments. and it's not a nice thing to discover.
You know the right way to get them off, right?
Yeah, fire.
Right. You got to kind of turn it and then you have to light it on. Oh, man. It's a whole thing. And it's fine when it's on your arm. It's okay to do that. But when it's like, in a sensitive area, that's a real rite of passage. You know what I mean? Because I was, without giving away too much information, I was one of the people who always thought, I am going to do this on my own. This is a dark mm-hmm. tunnel I will travel through alone. But it turns out, Buffy, that quite a few people believe that Lyme disease was perhaps produced by Plum Island. Were produced on Plum Island. So many people, in fact, that in July of 2019, the U.S. House of Representatives voted successfully to order the Department of Defense to investigate whether the Pentagon had ever developed ticks as biological weapons. And the implication there is that the Pentagon would have to disclose that information, which they totally wouldn't tell you if they did that. They would have to disclose that information, and they would also have to disclose whether any of those little critters escaped to cause the national Lyme disease epidemic. And 600,000 people, just for the record, does qualify as an epidemic, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so. The weird thing to me is that it was a question of whether or not they were manufacturing ticks rather than some kind of disease. Or I guess you would be manufacturing ticks because you'd be fostering a disease through a population. I don't know. It's just, I think it's weird to think about it in that way, of like a factory where ticks are being made.
That's a really good point. Yeah, that's like blaming rats for the plague, right? Rats are carriers, but they're not the plague itself. Yeah, Lyme disease is caused by a bacterium, Borrelia bacterium. And the most common sign of this is a red rash. Now, again, earlier when we were talking about this off air, I think several of us had assumed that I was told at times that Lyme disease is incurable. Luckily, that turns out not to be the case. The vast majority of it can be treated with antibiotics, which is great news for anybody stuck out in the woods. But the Plum Island thing is so fascinating because it is relatively rare for a conspiratorial belief to garner so much momentum that it is addressed in the halls of Congress. You know what I mean? When you think about it, this puts Lyme disease up there with 9/11 and JFK.
It really does. In terms of
that government response. So we have some good or bad news, depending whether you believe the official story. Apparently, per a Cumming School professor named Sam Telford, a leading expert on infections spread by mosquitoes as well as ticks, this conspiracy theory is wrong, and it's been soundly debunked by the work that Professor Telford says he did with one David Persing in the early 1990s, which is interesting because that's, I keep forgetting that the 90s was, what, 30 years ago by now? So in their studies, they did multiple studies. One was published in Science. One was published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. They tested specimens of white-footed mice and deer ticks to see if they had DNA evidence of being infected with the bacterium responsible for Lyme disease. And what they found was a timeline problem with the theory. Ticks that were collected in 1945 from the east side of Long Island and mice that were collected in 1894 in Cape Cod were both found to be infected with this bacterium, which means that this thing that causes Lyme disease already existed before the time period that the conspiracy centers on. So the predecessor to Plum Island was a thing called Fort Terry that was made by the Army Chemical Corps and it wasn't even around until like activated until 1952. So the scary thing about Lyme disease in this regard is that Lyme disease was already in the wild. We just learned more about it over time. And of course, that is, we should add the caveat, the little asterisk about the size of some ticks on your printed page that says, if you believe the official story. But what are you guys' takes on this?
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask. I have a quick take and then a quick, very, very brief pivot slightly away from this topic to something very quick that I wanted to bring up. This thinking about this brought me back to, and let me let the cat out of the bag here, not be too mysterious. I first heard of Lyme disease from the real world Seattle. There's a character, and I say character, and again, I'm talking about this because it's an interesting crossover between our, between this topic and our episode about reality TV, which you can listen to now. But yeah, Irene, I had to correct myself from calling her a character. This person that was on the Real World Seattle had Lyme disease, and there was a big kerfuffle at the end of that season that many folks might not remember, but I do, just because I remember her having Lyme disease and the way the producers sort of used that as an explanation for her leaving the show. And there was almost some kind of gaslighting behavior that went into her depiction as sort of a crazy person who was addled by Lyme disease and caused to become delusional because of this condition. And there's actually an interesting op-ed on Vulture where
Irene talks about this and talks about the nature of reality television. And there was an event when she left the show where someone who she had been feuding with, a man by the name of Steven, actually slaps her in the face, runs out to her car as she's leaving, throws her bunny rabbit, like stuffed animal that she left behind in the water over this bridge, and then opens the car door and slaps her in the face. And she just talks about in this op-ed, A, how she was kind of demonized through editing, and also, I mean, she was a difficult person on the show, I do remember that, but also the Lyme disease angle that was used as sort of a weapon to indicate that she was somehow not in her right mind because of the progression of this condition, which she says in this Vulture piece is a disservice to people with Lyme disease, that it's not a thing, and that she really, looking back on it now, was unfair the way she was treated and unfair to people with Lyme disease. And when she saw these episodes, the way they did it back then, the cast members were sent VHS copies of these episodes, like that they would receive maybe a day before the real thing aired on television. And she didn't think they would air this part or put it in this context. And she was blown away to find out that they did. And she just talks about reality television. This is quoting from the piece. It's changed so much since I was on The Real World Today. There's no end to the pain we now witness on reality TV. Cast members don't have to be goaded by producers to fight physically and emotionally. These wannabe stars go in knowing that regular screaming, feuding, and hair pulling is expected of them, and they want to deliver in order to get airtime. So sorry, the weird pivot, I know, but I think interesting with the Lyme disease angle, the way it was portrayed, and also a callback to what we've just very much discussed on our reality TV episode.
Yeah, seems like a good example of Frankenbiting and retroactively redefining reality. Yeah, I was thinking a little bit too about narcissistic influences and producers, right? And gaslighting. There's a dark triumvirate there, not the one you're thinking of. That's a different story for a different episode. But let's end this on something positive and actionable for people who want to avoid Lyme disease, just in case you need to hear these again. It's always helpful if you're going out and camping, and now this is lovely camping weather time. Cover up, long pants, especially if you're in tall grass. Insect repellent, find one that works for you. Always check your clothing, yourself. And if you have pets, check them too. They'll appreciate the attention because, you know, you're just scratching them. Check your children, of course. Do not assume that you are immune. And if you do get a tick, safely remove it as soon as possible. And do not mail it to Plum Island. I'm sure someone has. I'm sure they don't want to get that mail. It might be a crime. I don't know.
And maybe avoid walking in tall grass wearing shorts, you know?
Yeah.
Just a word to the wise.
Yep. As I said, like wear long pants in tall grass, even if it's hot, long sleeves as well. Thank you so much, Taters. Thank you so much, Buffy. Thank you so much, Anonymous, for tuning in and for writing to us, for calling us. To everyone else who's inspired to weigh in with your thoughts on the strange interaction of biblical tales and secular history, the identity of the Sea Peoples, to everyone who has a story of a possible biological weapon or an explanation of how Lyme disease is one, we'd love to hear from you, and to everyone who has firsthand experience with the foster care system. We would like to hear from you. We try to make it easy to find us. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. All over the internet, really, we like to recommend, here's where it gets crazy, our Facebook community page. But what if you hate social media?
If you don't like social media, call our number. It is 1-833-STDWYTK. That last part is just stuff they don't want you to know in acronym form or numbers, alphanumerical. You get it.
How would you say it if it were an acronym, Matt?
Stididwick. And if you do say that, make it a part of your regular everyday vernacular. Why not? Hey, I was listening to Stididwick yesterday, and
how old are you, Stididwicks?
But yes, give that number a call. Leave a message. Keep it as brief as you can. That's the best. Send us down a rabbit hole. Tell us your experience. Whatever you want to do, you've got 3 minutes. Let us know if you're okay with us using it on one of these episodes. Very much appreciate it. Yeah, all you have to do is leave your first name if you want to be kind of anonymous. If you want to be fully anonymous, just say that's what you want.
Yep.
It's fine.
Yep, we are more than happy to oblige. And as Ben often says, you are, in fact, the best part of the show. And if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have had this episode that we just wrapped up. So thank you once again to everyone that wrote in and to everyone out there listening. If you don't want to do that stuff, but you still want to get in touch with us, you can also send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.